morning. So hopefully you're here for CSO2. So I'm Professor Charles Rice. This is Professor Brad Campbell. We'll be co-teaching this course. And since we have combined labs, we basically intend to switch off by topic. So I'll be handling our first set of topics, and then Brad Campbell will be handling next set, and we'll adjust as needed throughout the semester. And this also means that we intend to give essentially the same lectures in the 9:30 section as the 12:30 section over there. Warner Hall, that's what that building's called. And have the same lab, same TAs, basically the same exams. We'll go over some more logistics later. So let's talk about what we're gonna do in this course, things we're gonna cover, are my little elevator pitch for why you should care about this course. I know some people won't be convinced by that, but we'll try it. So I'm gonna, like, this is my like little list of big themes that come up, you know, in this course, trying to tie our topics together. There's some parts of this course where, you know, there are things that are in this course because people making the curriculum for the CS department said, gosh, it would be really embarrassing if our students didn't graduate without knowing this. And that makes some of our, you know, what we'll cover later in the semester awkward. So for example, we have a short unit on networking in this course, basically for that reason. It would be really embarrassing if people graduated and didn't know some networking basics, but that means it's kind of, you know, in the middle of this course and a bunch of other things. So some big things we'll be covering. So we're going to start off by talking a little about automating building software. We're going to look at makefiles, which if you've looked on the schedule is the first lab next week. A little bit libraries, taking advantage of automated compilation, so that I think is pretty directly useful. And we're going to look at the specific example of makefiles, but a bunch of the things that makefiles do are kind of what everything that builds software does. And the big thing we'll see that makefiles do is that, well, when we set things up properly, we can have our executable program that's built from a whole bunch of different things. You know, because, you know, eventually you'll probably work on software projects that are a whole bunch of files. Maybe this is a small number of files. Maybe, like, you know, if we're thinking of like a web browser, like 10,000 files. And the idea is you edit a file and then you run one command and it figures out how to rebuild things without making you spend the time rebuilding absolutely everything by hand and forgetting a step. You know, which, you know, or always recompiling everything even when not everything has changed. So we'll talk about how that works. That's kind of our first topic. Then we're going to go into things that are more kind of on the computer organization and architecture side. And I kind of divided the topics into kind of a bunch of themes there. So one is with sharing machines. So we're going to talk about a lot of things in the hardware and software side about letting us share machines. So those of you who took CSO1 here probably use Portal or No Machine, and those are machines that are shared with multiple students. And the model that you learned for how processors work in CSO1, that doesn't actually work there, like, because that model is, there's a program counter, there are registers, and there's a memory. And that doesn't actually make sense if we think my program is running alongside your program. And when my program crashes because I wrote it horribly, it doesn't cause your program to crash, usually. So we'll talk about, like, how does that work? You know, and one big mechanism we're going to spend a lot of time talking about is something called address translation. So in order to share the memory of a machine, when we've told you, oh, you access a specific memory address by dereferencing a pointer, that's not really what's happening. Instead, you're accessing something where the OS has decided it goes to some other part of memory. And this means that when we have kind of multiple programs running at the same time, that they access independent memory, even though they think they're accessing the same address, because we have this mapping, and we'll talk very specifically about what does this mapping look like, and how does it work. There's also some other things going on here that we'll discuss. So one is I have this box labeled trigger exception. Right, so what do I mean by exception? I don't mean Java exceptions, as we'll talk about later. This is something different. This is like, what are seg faults? So we're going to talk about that. And also, we can see that something that has to go on in here is that we have the operating system running. And the operating system also needs to share the machine with our user programs in some way. And usually, modern machines make it unlikely that your user program will accidentally break the OS. And this address space mechanism is part of how we're going to achieve that. And along with sharing our sort of space on the machine, so this address space idea is how we share machines' sort of storage, or at least the memory side of storage. Another thing we want to share is the processor time. And even if we're running multiple things on a machine, we often run more things on a machine than we have processors to do. So you probably know that most machines have multiple cores these days. But if I look at how many, what we'll learn are called threads are running, we have more programs running at a time on a typical laptop or desktop than there are cores. So in order to make that happen, we have to have the OS kind of switching between different programs. And one big way this happens is that, let's say I input something from the keyboard, that the OS gets involved, and it's not the case that while I'm asking, waiting for a key press, that my program is on the processor, checking for that key press, That's not how it works. Instead, that program makes this request to the operating system, and the operating system runs some other stuff on that same processor, and this provides the illusion that even if I have only one processor, it looks like I can run, 50 different programs at once. They aren't actually running at once. They're doing this thing that we'll sometimes call time multiplexing. We're sharing this one processor over time. If we have multiple cores, we'll do the same thing for each of the cores simultaneously. So we might have like 8 cores, but we'll run like 100 programs on them at the same time. And they can't actually run at the same time because 8 cores have, 8 program counters. We can't have 100, programs with their own program counters and own stack pointers on 8 program counters and 8 stack pointers. So we'll share it by switching over time. And if you're thinking of a specific program running, this kind of provides us the illusion that we just have a processor that runs weirdly. So if I'm running my infinite loop program, it's going to look like my infinite loop program just runs, but the timing is a little weird. It runs for a little bit, and then the processor stops that it appears to run on, so on. So I think of my program, I'm running my loop, and then there's this like really long delay. From my perspective, it's just a weirdly, timed processor. But what's actually happening is that the OS is running some other stuff in between. And I've so far been showing this as kind of we have different independent programs. But another thing we'll talk about is that often we'll try to write one program to have multiple of what we'll call threads. So multiple, take advantage of kind of multiple virtual processors. And this could be implemented by having ROS switch between those different threads on one processor. But often the reason we're doing that is we want to take advantage of multiple actual cores with their own, you know, ALUs and so on, so we can do multiple things at once and take advantage of having more computation available. You know, and one way we might imagine this happening is, like, say, a web browser. We have graphic stuff and we have networking stuff, and those are kind of sort of independent programs, but they do interact. And we'll talk about kind of both how that works and how we can write programs that take advantage of having extra computational resources in this kind of way. And as we'll learn, kind of a big concern in this is that, you know, these programs, when we have two things actually happening at once, there are things we need to think about that don't come up in programs we've seen before that don't have that problem. Okay. So, questions on my kind of first few themes before I go through. Okay. So, related to sharing machines, so talked about sharing memory and sharing the processor, and kind of talked about the mechanics of doing that sharing. Another topic we'll touch on related to having multiple different users on a machine is talking about how permissions work. So if you log into Portal and try to access some other user's stuff, or try to shut down, you know, whatever Portal machine you're logged into, that won't work. Yeah, so we'll talk about what's the mechanism for tracking who's allowed to do what, and how is that actually enforced. If we think of our model from CSO1, we were just saying, oh, your program just runs instructions on a processor. So we'll say, why can't, if my program's just running instructions on the processor, why can't it run the shut down the machine instruction? What's stopping that from happening? And we'll talk about that. And how, if my program can't run it, why can't some other programs do that? What's making those programs actually different from each other? So another thing we'll talk about briefly is kind of things that are going a little beyond the very basic coverage of sockets we have in CSO1. So CSO1, I believe most of you have seen, basically using sockets as kind of sort of like a terminal between two machines. You know, a file connecting two machines together without talking about how that works. So we're gonna go a little more into how that works. We're not gonna go into a huge amount of detail. If you want a huge amount of detail, take networking, CS4457. And we're also gonna talk a bit about implementing secure communication and some little basics of cryptography. This is kind of one of those topics where, you know, it'd be kind of embarrassing if people graduated with a CS degree and didn't know a little bit about this, because it's kind of everywhere, etc. And the big thing we'll talk about with networking is we'll look at this kind of layered design. So the big concept that kind of networking uses is that we don't just have a program that implements sockets, you know, and the whole thing at once. Instead, it's kind of implemented in these pieces that are modular with each other. And so this gives us a layered design where, you know, sockets are that you've used are an implementation of TCP, but they don't handle all the functionality. So sockets don't handle the actual, how do I get messages from Virginia to California, for example, even though we can use them to do that. That functionality is handled by this kind of lower layer, which can be used independently of TCP. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And also about some issues related to that. And we'll talk a bit about secure communication. And this is mostly going to be talking about some mathematical tools. I want to try to focus on a more practical aspect of that. So we'll be kind of focusing more on how do we safely use some tools that mathematicians are going to give us for doing secure communication. And we're talking about that more than what's the actual math like. We're kind of going to mostly say, here's the math, they give us math which has these properties, we're not going to be concerned about how that's possible. That's a different course. And finally, the other big topic we have in this course is the architecture-related topic, and maybe the one which provokes the most complaints of, I don't ever need this. And this is kind of talking about how processors are fast. So the model of processor you learn in CS01 has this idea that we run one instruction, you know, and for every instruction, basically, we read something from memory to read the instruction. If the instruction accesses memory, we do another access to memory in that instruction. And after we finish running one instruction, we run the next instruction. And this is not how modern, fast laptop, desktop, and mobile phone processors work. And we're going to talk about what those processors do at a high level. And there's kind of two areas we're going to talk about. So one is with caches. So to kind of illustrate kind of the importance of caches, I have this dive photo. So this is a microscope photo of a CPU from 2004. Why a CPU from 2004? Well, two reasons. So one is that this is a production desktop single core CPU, and after 2004, those are harder to find. And two is that someone helpfully located all the important things in this dive photo, and that's hard to do. And so this is a single core, and let's talk about where the storage is here on this sort of actual single core from 20 years ago. So here's where the registers are. So the registers are this teeny bit of storage. You might wonder, why are they in two different places? We have some registers over here that are the floating point registers, and they're stored physically separate from the integer registers because the floating point math circuits are in a different place from this processor. And they want the registers for those close by. So that's our kind of primary storage, and you know from assembly that like you access those directly in assembly instructions. And we also have our memory, and if you read this diagram, you'll see that this whole thing around this outside here is the memory interface. So somewhere off this chip, there's a bunch of wires that go to a memory chip. And that's where the main memory is. But when you typically access memory, that's not what happens. Instead, we have these caches, these small storage that tries to store part of the stuff that's in that off-chip memory in some fast place. And we see here that these parts of the chip, we have these two level one caches, these first caches, which is where sort of typical data is stored. We have this data cache up here. So our hope is most of the time, even though I have this big off-chip storage for memory, most of the time my accesses go, when I have an instruction that loads or stores something, they go to this data cache that's way smaller and obviously can't hold nearly as much because it's so much smaller. And there's also this instruction cache, which is basically the same size, which is when I'm fetching an instruction, I need to read it from memory. And what we hope is that we don't actually go way over here to get, you know, off the chip to get my instruction, that instead we somehow arrange for that instruction to be stored in this instruction cache, because it's going to be much faster. Now, we can't always have things in these small caches, because, well, that's impossible. Like, they just aren't big enough. You know. So, but we're going to have sometimes to go to memory, but we don't always want to go to memory, so it's kind of in between. This processor has a level 2 cache, which is basically half the chip. So the designers at AMD decided that it's worth spending over half our space budget here on caches, well over half, on stuff that's just storing a copy of stuff that's already in memory. And here we have this L2 cache. This is 1 megabyte of storage, just 1 megabyte. And yeah, no, yes, we had smaller memories in 2004, not that much smaller. You still have like a gigabyte pretty often. And so we have our L2 cache. And I have this diagram here where we have, this is often we think of this as a memory hierarchy. So we have our registers, they're the smallest storage, and they store kind of the things for the shortest duration. Then we have L1 cache that's a little bigger, L2 cache. And on a modern system, we often have a third level of cache. So kind of, if you think, look at a typical modern processor design, this thing, which was a whole chip in 2004, will often be like an eighth of a die, eighth of a chip on a modern system. And you'll have like eight of these or six of these on one chip and some extra cache that's called a level 3 cache that's shared between the different cores. And then you'll have main memory. And kind of the reason why we have all this effort devoted to caches and all this space, this physical space that we could have used to, for example, have more floating point computers. So if you look at this processor, this is the floating point circuit is in there, and that's not including the floating point registers. It takes up that little much space. And that's doing floating point division, which is enormously complicated. So they're devoting like 10, 20 times as much space to this caches as to making floating point division efficient. And they could have decided we're going to do more floating point division stuff, and they didn't feel like that was worthwhile. Yeah.
I think nowadays it would be an AI accelerator is what you'd use the space for.
Nowadays, I think it's still both.
That's true.
Yeah. I guess a trend which has happened, you know, is that feature sizes have gotten smaller on processors, and I think the usage is both more computational elements, and often this comes up as GPUs or AI accelerators, and more storage, like these caches. But the big reason we have all these caches is that the access time gets so much better when you have these smaller storages. So registers, like, we access all the times in every instructions, and a typical processor of this design can access like 6 or 8 registers per cycle. And then we have these small L1 caches. And because they're small, you know, typical access is like takes like 3 cycles, and maybe we can do 1 or 2 per cycle. And our L2 cache, because it's bigger, is going to be a bit slower. Processors that have L3 caches, those are more modern, bigger processors, then L3 cache is even slower. So we get more and more benefit if we can figure out how to have the important data in these smaller pieces of storage, just because there's such a speed difference. And often, you know, my numbers are approximate, so, but this is like order of magnitude. It's still often the case that accessing main memory is going to be 100 times slower than reading something from a register, and like 50 times slower than reading something from the L1 cache. So we're going to talk about how these caches work, and in knowing that, we'll also know like what you as a programmer can do to predict or influence when things are accessing these caches versus accessing main memory, which can have a very big performance effect. So that's with storage. Another thing which happens is that we learn that modern processors don't just execute one instruction, then execute the next instruction, execute the next instruction. That's the model we taught in CS01, partly because that is the simplest way you build a processor. And if you look at like simple processors, especially low power processors, that's what they do. But we can actually kind of execute multiple parts of different instructions at the same time. And if you're a programmer, this means that performance is much less intuitive than what you learn in CS01 would suggest. So for example, I have these two loops. And if we count the number of instructions in these loops, what we're doing is we have this counter that I set to 10 billion, and I decrement the counter until it goes to 0. And I do that in both loops. And I have one instruction that's doing some math here, and two instructions that are doing some math. So you would say, naively, that, well, we have basically 3/4 of the instructions on the left side versus the right side. So it should be shorter. If I actually run this, it takes pretty much exactly the same amount of time. And we'll learn why that's the case, how we could have predicted that this would happen. And kind of basically what's going on is the way my desktop processor actually executes these instructions is that it can do kind of all of these instructions at once, or all of these instructions at once, but it can't easily do kind of multiple iterations together at once. It's not quite that way. We'll learn exactly what the details of what's going on, but the thing which is happening is that the two add instructions could happen at the same time, so the extra add instruction is kind of free. What's happening when I run this shorter loop is that I just have an adder that the processor isn't using, versus when I run the larger loop, that adder is actually used. And I think there's some value in knowing this because, you know, this will give you a better idea of like what makes things slow or fast on a typical, you know, real processor. It's not your intuition very often. And if you don't understand what's really going on, it's not a fetch, execute, write result, fetch, execute, write result. It's not that model that we learned from CS01. Okay, so questions? All right. Thanks.
No questions?
No questions.
Okay, I have one. Okay, so you mentioned sharing, right, multiple times.
Yes.
Does that also apply to the caches on the processor? Are those shared with multiple programs?
So the question is, are the caches shared? Yes. And we will talk about, actually, yes, very specifically about some security consequences of that are kind of our last topic. So talk incompletely, I would say. And pretty much everything on the processor is shared. We won't talk about what Intel calls hyper-threading and what other people call hardware threads or SMT. But that's another way things are shared on the processor at the like register level. Other questions? Okay, so let's... Oh, okay. Should make sure I'm actually looking around the room. Let's talk a little about C stuff. So we have assignments that use C and pointers. And some of our early assignments are meant to kind of get you to actually, you know, review that because it comes up a bunch later. So I have a little exercise here. I want to know what's the final value of array. So I'll give you a minute or two. You can discuss with your neighbor what you think is going on here. And we'll take a poll raising hands.
Thank you.
years.
Okay, who likes some more time? Okay, so let's see who thinks our answer is A, that there's a compile or runtime error when we do this. Okay, no one thinks it's B. Okay, C, D, E, F, no clue. Okay, so we have a pretty good consensus for B, so I'll go through this quickly. So initially, P is going to point to the first element of this array. This is element 0, 1, 2, 3, because arrays in C are indexed starting with 0. Then I do plus equals 2, and this is advance by 2 of what the pointer points to. So it doesn't matter that our pointers, if we look at them in assembly, contain byte numbers, and advancing by 2 array elements is not advancing by 2 bytes, it's probably advancing by 8. C takes that into account when we do the pointer arithmetic. So this means that at this point, our P is going to point here, to element 2. And then I try to pretend that P is an array. And if we think of this P here, we have P of 0 would be the 30, and P of 1 is this 40, which we're adding 1 to, so it becomes 41. So that's how we get B. Any questions about that? Yes?
When accessing the parent's array, when do you use a star?
Question, when do we use a star to access? So kind of the general rule, so I guess when do we use a star? So there's one thing which is confusing here, which is that there's a difference between declaring a pointer and using it. So we always use a star when declaring a pointer to indicate that we have a pointer. And otherwise, if I use P, this is the kind of address. And if I use star P, this is the thing at the address. So if I did, for example, star P plus equals 2, that would change this 30 to 32 at the end, because that P pointed to 30. If I do P plus equals 2, that would advance P to the memory just past the end of the array.
Okay. So the brackets assume that you have an address?
Question, the brackets assume we have an address? Yes, so there's two ways of looking at this sort of P of X syntax. So one way you can look at it is that this is pretend P is the points to an array, the beginning of an array of array and access element X. Another way we can think of it is that we can do P plus X and dereference that. Other questions about? Yes?
If you did P of 2 plus equal 1,
At the end here, that would be accessing this memory that's out of the array. So that would be undefined behavior. I don't use the word segfault. So undefined behavior is C's term for we don't specify what happens. And in practice, sometimes that will mean a segfault. And sometimes that'll mean something else will happen. And this is a case where there really is variation. So as we'll learn later, a segfault is kind of a result of that address mapping the OS sets up not having a space there. The way that address mapping is set up, very often, just after this array, there will be something there that's possible to access, so it won't be a segfault. And if you're lucky, that thing won't be important, so it won't cause any problems. If you're unlucky, that will be something important, so it won't segfault, and it will change something important and probably be bad. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions?
like the previous elements after you increment p by 2?
So the question is, can I access things, you know, that are before p at when I increment it? And the answer is absolutely yes. So for example, it would be valid to do p of minus 1, you know, equals x to change 20 to x. And this is following this equivalence here that I'm doing star p plus negative 1 equals x. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's do this one. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so the plurality answer seems to be C, with some people thinking that A is right. Let me go through things here. So our initial setup here is that I have Q is array of 2, and this is another way of writing a pointer to the beginning of Q. So that means that Q points to the first element of array of 2. And if we look at the type here, Q is an array of pointers. Sorry, array two is an array of pointers, and Q is a pointer to a pointer, so that makes sense. We're pointing to the first element of array of 2. And I pass Q to mystery. So P, mystery's argument, is a copy of that pointer. So it's a value that points to the same place, but it's an independent pointer. Isn't relevant here, but if I change P, it wouldn't change Q. And then I dereference P, so I'm accessing this thing here, and I'm setting it to point to array 1 of 2. So this is going to point to here. This is array 1 of 2 after we run that line. And then I return to main, and I run this line here. This array 1 of 1 equals star Q. So Q, this is Q is here. Star Q is this. So star Q is the address of array 1 of 2. So if we just think of this assignment as happening, what I'd expect is I get array 1, I'd have this array 1 be replaced with the address of array 2 of 0, sorry, array 1 of 2, which is, you know, array 1 of 2, which is this value here. Their value in the first slot of array 2. But, and so that would be a way you could get the answer F. But there's a problem with this assignment here, and it's a type problem. And that's that this here, this is an int. This here, this is an int pointer. And you may have set your compiler to warn you about that, which I would strongly recommend. Actually, GCC and Clang warn about this by default. It is not always an error by default. However, you should treat it like an error, because almost certainly it will not give you the expected results, as we saw here, where she said, oh, well, you know, that thing is associated with array 1 of 2, therefore you expected reasonably 30, but that's not what happens because we have the address of that versus the value there. And so I would say A and F are valid answers. Probably F is technically correct because if we compile in kind of the default way, it's usually just a warning. Would make sense to compile so it's an error, or pretend that warning's an error. And as for how do we get the behavior that most of you expected, you know, which would be arguably the bug in this code, and that would be that instead of this, we could write array 1 of 1 equals star Q. Or sorry, not star Q. We could write star Q. So rather than just going here, we go two steps. And our pointer is not just one. Some questions to this? Yes?
Say again what happens after you pass Q into mystery.
Can I say what happens after I pass Q into mystery? It copies the value of Q, and the value of Q is the address of that first slot of array 2. So P in mystery points to the first slot of array 2. Does that answer your question? Array 2, no, array 2. So Q points to this first slot of array 2 here.
Yeah.
And P is a copy of Q, so it points to the same place. But it's an independent copy, meaning that, for example, if I did something like, you know, P plus equals 1, that wouldn't change the answer. Because changing P wouldn't change Q. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So that was a harder step. Okay. So I'm a little more optimistic about pointer knowledge in this version of in this lecture than I've often been, because often that first exercise has much worse results. But some of you may still want to review, like I do recommend like reviewing CSO 1 stuff and some other exercises we've used in the past. And there's some other pointer things I want to specifically go over that are related to kind of the issue with our second exercise of like using pointer in direction. And like when things are pointers versus not. So let's say here I have an array, and I have this array is at address 0x2c here. And I have this value signal at address 0x28 and this pointer that's stored before them in memory. And if I just, try to set pointer, the value pointer points to something, this is hopefully a runtime error, because this is going to try to say, where does pointer point? Well, we don't know. And I'm mentioning this because this is very commonly a thing I see people do on the early homeworks, is that you forget that, you have a pointer that might make sense to have a pointer, like for a string in the first homework. It has to point somewhere, or nothing's going to work. So we first want to set the pointer to point somewhere, and we're going to do that by not dereferencing it when we do that. So I can make it point to signal, or I can do this not recommended of knowing the address of signal, casting that explicitly to a pointer, and doing it. But that's what that assignment is doing. And those aren't the same as saying pointer equals signal. That's saying I want to use the ALU in signal as a number that's an address and make the pointer use that address. That's the value of signal. Probably not what you want. And if you want to set a pointer to a specific address, which usually you won't have a reason to do, though we have one assignment where that might come up, you should use a cast. And I'll put compile error, hopefully. Hopefully, but maybe just warning. You want it to be a compile error because usually this is an error problem. And once I have the pointer set up, I can dereference it to assign things. Also, we can assign pointers to array, and we have, I think people are comfortable with that. When I use an array like a pointer, it decays into a pointer to the first element. They're basically the same. And that's still not the same as like saying the pointer is equal to the first element of the array. We have this address versus value distinction we want to be careful about. And we can think of our array indexing, as I mentioned, as kind of a shorthand for pointer arithmetic. So one other thing which comes up is passing pointers to functions. And I'm mentioning this specifically because we'll see this pattern a bunch this semester in functions you need to use that are provided by the system. So instead of returning a value, something that you'll often see functions do is they'll take in an argument that's a pointer, and they'll use that pointer to change what the pointer points to. And in this example, this seems kind of silly, right? Why wouldn't I just do single equals some, foo, instead of passing a pointer to signal? Where it's going to seem less silly is when what we want to do is we want to have a function like return two values. And in Python, you can actually do that. You can return a tuple. In C, that's not really an option. So what you'll often see C APIs do, because this is not possible, is the function will return one of the values and take a pointer to the other one, and therefore modify using that pointer that other value. And we'll see this pattern a whole bunch of times this semester in things you need to use in assignments, which is why I'm mentioning it here. Some questions? Yes. Yeah.
When you say the functions are provided by the system, is there a specific system you have to use, or is this like a...
When I say functions that are provided by the system, is there a specific system? By the system, I mean like Linux on Fortal.
Okay.
There are functions in the sort of Linux standard library that we will use that have this interface. Other questions?
I have one.
Yeah.
In your first example, where you're using the pointer that wasn't declared.
Yeah.
This will give you a compiler warning or error?
This is usually a runtime error. So a runtime error, by runtime error, I mean usually something like a seg fault. Sometimes you might get lucky, and it's just going to change something. And hopefully that's not important. And if you're really lucky, it will change something that will like make things break in a very hard to debug way, which I've had happen before. That the pointer just happens to have an old value that happens to be a value on the stack that happens to be some other variable. And why is this variable changing? And find out after a few hours. Okay, so that's a little C review. Other C review questions? Okay, so as I mentioned, we'll have two sections. We'll be lectures alternating by topic with which one of us leads them. We'll have the same labs, homeworks, quizzes, same exams. Mostly, for logistical reasons, we might want to have something be different between the two. We have labs. So for labs, you should attend the lab in person and get checked out for PTA, or for most but not all labs, you have the option of submitting something to the submission site and we'll grade it. If you submit to the submission site and we allow that for the lab, we don't care if you attend the lab. But we will be more strict about grading submissions because we don't know what you did. We can't ask you questions. So if something seems incomplete and we can't ask you questions at the time, well, you're not going to get credit for it. Whereas in the lab, you know, the TA will just ask you a follow-up question, you know, or they know you actually worked on something and they can more easily give you credit. And also for in-person lab checkoff, if you're in-person and check off with the TA and the TA doesn't have reason to believe you weren't actually working for most of the lab, you should get 50% credit regardless of whether things work. We're not going to do that for submissions. If you submit something that doesn't work at all, I'm not going to try to speculate how much time you spent. I'm just going to say that's like a 25 or whatever. And as I mentioned, some labs will require attendance. And for those labs, you know, you need to contact me if you can't make it. There is not an option not to do it. And in general, if you can't make the lab, we can arrange a late in-person checkoff or something like that. Like if you're sick or have some other good reason for not attending the lab in person, let us know. We can handle that. Yes?
If you do get an incomplete lab and an in-person lab checkoff, will there be like a chance to like work on it for like practice or for like to like complete the rest of the grade, for lack of a better term?
Quick question, if you don't complete the lab in the lab time, can you work on it later? So the lab submission is due Thursdays at noon. So yes. And it's Thursdays at noon, so people in the 6:30 lab don't feel like they're obliged to start early. The idea is you get some sleep and work on it the next morning or late at night, depending on what your schedule is. And also, labs, as we'll talk about with the late policy, allow some late submission. Now, that submission is subject to that stricter grading, as I mentioned. Also, in some cases, lab submissions are not auto-rated because there's some things we can't auto-grade. So you won't know how you did, whereas with a checkoff, you will. Generally, the other reason to go to lab is labs allow collaboration. So in lab, we'd like you to collaborate. If you're doing that, please indicate on anything you submit or show TAs who you work with. So lab space. So lab sections, a lot of you are in some of the later lab sections and maybe prefer not to be. I don't intend to have a strictly enforce which lab you go to, but if labs are full, and the reason you can't register for the 2 or 3:30 p.m. lab, for the most part, is because the space is full, TAs have been told to kick students out who are in the wrong lab section. If there's space, we'll let you in. Otherwise, priority is given to people who are actually registered for that lab time, which is mostly a problem for the earlier labs. Attending a later lab, less of a problem, though probably still a problem for 5 p.m., probably not a problem for 6:30, but you know, we just have only have so much space, and I cannot get more rooms at 2 and 3:30. That is just not a thing that exists. Or I guess I probably could get more rooms, but you'd hate that even more if I got that big auditorium in the nursing school. What's that building? What?
McLeod,
yes, McLeod, yeah, if I got that over there, you probably would not be happy about that as a lab location overall. So, we also have homework assignments.
Wait, I have a question about labs.
Yes.
So, if for whatever reason I can't get it done during the lab session, but I can turn it in late, can I go to office hours?
Oh.
And be like, and show the TA at that point?
Okay, yes, I should mention this. Yes. So, submitting labs. So we might have office hours like on Thursday and Friday. TAs have been told to not check things off outside of the lab time. If you have a good reason that you can't do the lab in person, we can arrange an in-person check off. This is not something TAs will do. The main reason for this is I don't want Thursday office hours to be a line of people trying to get checked off for the lab instead of people getting help for the homework that's due Friday. Okay. So on homeworks, we have several homework assignments that will be done individually, so there's no collaboration except when explicitly mentioned for the homeworks. They're generally due on Fridays. There's one exception to that. Two exceptions? One exception to that. Tentative dates are in the schedule. We might move those dates around depending how lectures go and so on. There's some automatic testing for homeworks in labs. With some delay after you submit, sometimes pretty fast, sometimes tens of minutes, depending on how complicated the tests are, what else is going on the testing server. When my testing program doesn't understand or can't test something, it will be left for manual grading, and it will read not yet graded. Often this means something is actually wrong, and you know, we just don't know. Sometimes it's something in between. You know, it should be some sort of partial credit, but we can't have that be determined automatically. But that's what that means. So there's some assignments where we just can't auto grade something. So like we have an upcoming timing homework where we have you like write a text file that's not auto graded. Someone has to read it. But some things it will be like, if your program crashes, we aren't gonna automatically give you a zero. We're gonna have someone figure out what happened. And if it's like a bug with our auto grader, if it's something that like is just an environment difference that we don't want to deduct credit for, we want to give you like half credit, we're gonna have someone look at it. That's why we'll say not yet graded, because the auto grader's not gonna determine that, some person looking at your code bill. My intention is that testing results are not surprises. So it will sometimes be the case that you'll think something works and you'll send it to the auto grader and it won't. But the intention is that you can look at the assignment and test things manually and submit them, and almost all the time, you should not be surprised about what sort of results you get. And I would recommend you test things yourself, because it's going to be really hard to debug from the auto grader results. They're not intended for debugging. They are intended for us testing things relatively thoroughly. But the intention is that there's not like secret hidden test cases that you won't anticipate from the assignments. That might happen by accident sometimes, but that's not what I'm trying to do. And if you think the testing program made a mistake, please submit a rerun request. We can have humans look at things in that case. The first assignment is the warm-up assignment. In this, you're going to write a C function to split a string into an array of strings with dynamic memory allocation. So this is intended to make sure you remember pointer stuff. And write a C program to call that function and take input and command line arguments to do that. And write a makefile for it. Everything but writing the makefile, you theoretically know how to do from CSO1 or your equivalent prereq. If you feel sketchy on that, you should start early. Other things. So we're going to have quizzes starting next week that are weekly, take-home, open notes, open books, open internet, but individual quizzes. They will be due 15 minutes before the first lecture and released sometimes after the last Thursday lecture. And four-ish questions about the lecture lab material for the prior week. Quizzes are going to have a place. I'll show what the quiz system looks like when it's more relevant. Homework comments, comments and work. We will use those to do manual grading and to like give partial credit. If you don't use it, we can't give you partial credit. So now, generally, I hope to avoid errors in quiz questions, but often there are either errors in quiz questions or the quiz question has some other interpretation that I and everyone and a bunch of TAs read the quiz question and never thought of. If you think there's a possible error, generally the procedure should be that make your best guess as to what is meant, use the comments field to explain what you were doing, and we'll give partial credit based on that and or adjust the key. In particular, because the quizzes are like released on a Thursday and due on a Tuesday, it's really mean for me to tell people on Monday, hey, here's this clarification for the quiz. And, you know, kind of screw over all the people who decided very responsibly that they're going to do the quizzes on Fridays because they have lots of class on Mondays. I don't want to do that. When the quizzes are out, we're not going to answer the quiz questions for you in office hours, but it's perfectly legitimate to ask about anything in lecture and so on, including, you know, examples in lecture and things like that. That would be often very relevant to the quiz. For the quiz, we often have gone over quiz questions in lecture. And we'll do that. So, you know, that's a fine thing to ask. Other logistics. So readings. In lieu of textbook, we have some readings. They're mostly originally written by Professor Shikanovich.
Wait,
yeah.
About the quizzes. So does this imply then that we can't submit quizzes late?
This does imply we can't submit quizzes late. I have a slide on late policy later.
Okay.
Yeah.
Will these slides be posted?
These slides will be posted? Yes, they should already be posted. Linked as logistics on the schedule page. So in lieu of textbook, we'll have readings, which are on the website. And the readings often link to some alternate or supplemental readings on a topic if you want some perspectives written by other people. And most of them were originally written by Professor Shikanovich, who's now at UAUC, but who originated this course when we did our curriculum change a few years ago. So lecture and labs, generally, you know, we're going to have kind of our labs following covering the topic in lecture and our homeworks following covering a topic in lab. This has the unfortunate consequence that sometimes the coverage of something in homeworks, labs, lectures might be a little offset from when we cover it in lecture. Well, I'm sorry, that's just what's going to happen. I'm going to try to make it not too bad. And also this interacts with like when breaks are and things like that. But just to let you know, especially for homeworks, because we sensibly want to have most of the homeworks after a corresponding lab on something. That's often is going to be the homework is going to be, a week or two after we've covered something in lecture. Exams. So we're going to have a final exam, and something that's different this semester is a midterm that's on the schedule. I have mixed opinions about doing this, so I will say personally, I have not had a midterm in a class since COVID. And there's some tension I'm kind of resolving here. So a thing that has happened in not having a midterm is I've had the quizzes be higher stakes and bigger. I'm going to try to make the quizzes quizzes are less of the grade now and a little smaller to kind of compensate for this. And one source of tension I have is like if people who are not learning the material in one way or another, either academic dishonesty or just, learning something only for the 15 seconds to fill in the quiz answer and not any for other time. And I'll see how I feel about doing this. Also, there's an issue that this kind of resolves is that when I have had a final, and the final is probably a lot more stressful when there's no midterm. But I'm not sure this is like 100% positive change, but this is what we're trying this semester. So other logistics. So development environment. All our assignments will be tested using something like SSHing into Portal. There are no restrictions regarding IDEs or similar, like you may have seen in some versions of 2130. But you need to run things from the command line. You should make sure you know how to do that, because that's what we'll be doing. Many students have had success using VS Code and SSH support. I don't use it, so I can't help you. Some of our TAs do, but I can try to help you, but I'm not going to be the best at it. Do it. So that would be option. As I mentioned, I don't use VS Code, but if you do it, you can use SSH support to run things on Portal using it, which is option. Office hours will be indicated on the calendar website. They're not quite posted yet because we still need to coordinate our TAs, figure out our own schedules. There's Piazza, which has private questions that a lot of people seem to forget. So if you want to show homework code on Piazza, make a private question, that's fine with us. And we'll look at things. Or you can email the instructors. Not really a preferable method, but it will work for some things. Collaboration, as I mentioned, you can work with other students in labs. Homeworks are individual. This means all the code should be written by yourself. You can ask conceptual questions. You should cite any sources you use. So I should be able to see, where things, that ideas you came up with that were yours came up with. Quizzes are also individual, but you can access like lecture notes and so on. That is perfectly fine. They don't have to be done in one sitting. Don't ask the questions to other students. Don't ask it on Stack Overflow. Don't look for exactly the quiz question on Stack Overflow or, on some generative AI tool and so on. I guess I should mention of others. And when I say ask conceptual questions of others, this is mentioned in the policies page, but not on the slide. The same policy applies for things like ChatGPT. If you can't ask another student for it, you can't ask something like ChatGPT for it. And you can't ask another student, please write me an IMake file. No, right? Same thing applies to any generative AI tools. I don't think generative AI tools are as useful as you think for this, because you can't easily verify the results. Or if you can, maybe you have a better way of doing the assignment. There's anonymous feedback on Canvas, which I would appreciate. This is not a way to ask for regrades or similar, because we won't know who you were. Late policy, no late quizzes. One quiz will be unconditionally dropped. For homeworks, between 0 and 72 hours late, you'll get 90% credit. If it's more than 72 hours late, you will get no credit, unless you talk to me. For labs that allow submission, not the ones that are checkoff only, it's 11:59 a.m. the next day, and 90% credit for up to 24 hours late. This is to avoid having the lab late time go over the homework deadline, so people have this cascading array of late deadlines. And no late lab checkoffs except by special arrangement. This is the late policy for unexcused lateness. We don't care why you're late, you have this 90% credit. If you have a good reason for being late, please contact us. We can often do things that are beyond what the late policy allows. And please do not go to lab or similar if you're sick. We'll figure something else out. Okay, as I mentioned, we won't take attendance in lecture. We will attempt to have lecture recordings. I'm not going to guarantee the lecture recordings will always work. So questions on logistics. Yes.
Is the final cumulative?
Is it separate from the final? We haven't decided yet. My guess is we'll do something like 2/3 of the final will be the last half of the semester, and 1/3 will be before that. Okay. Is there a date when the final will be? There is a tentative date on the schedule, which is the Tuesday before spring break. Yes. Question, if you're in the first lab section and you come to a later one, can you still get checked off?
Well, I mean, like, can you stay in your lab section and stay late?
Can you stay late and check off?
If
there's space, you can. If there's not space, we're going to pick you out. Yes?
Do the lectures cover all the reading content, or is it more content?
Question, do the lectures cover all the reading content? Not entirely. The lectures cover all the content we will test on, but there's probably a few things that are in the reading that aren't in lecture.
Okay. Is there anything in the lecture that's not in the reading?
Is there anything in the lecture that's not in the reading? There is a bit, yes. Mostly at the end of the semester, which I would like to fix long term, but I'm not sure it will happen this semester. Yes?
You may have already said this, but do we have lab this week?
Do we have lab this week? No. Okay, other logistics questions? Okay, so in my last minute, I'll give a preview of what we'll cover next time. So I believe you kind of learned about sort of building a program together in CSO1, and we're going to talk about that process and automating it. So here I have a program with a whole bunch of source files. I have main.c, main.h, extra.h, extra.c, and the process for turning that into executable has this whole bunch of steps that can actually be done independently. We have a step where we produce this object file that's basically the machine code version of main.c, and an object file that's the machine code version of extra.c, since they include header files, that also includes code from those header files. And that's combined with some system files into our program. So that's what we're going to talk about next time. So see you on Thursday.